Hello and welcome to the OnFIF podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment, economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. On this week's podcast, we talk about Facebook's Libra and its potential role in the global monetary system. This is Bhavin Patel from London, and today we talk to Christian Catalini, co-creator of Libra and head economist at Calibra, and also Tionis Brossens, lead economist for digital finance at ING Group. Thank you both for joining us today. Welcome. Let's start off by understanding what Libra is. We already heard a lot about the concept from the white paper, and there's a lot of heat and light around the concept on the news. So Christian, maybe you can remind us, what is Libra? What is it trying to achieve? And what are the main inspirations and motivations behind it?
So going back to Libra's mission, the goal is really to create a simple global currency and financial infrastructure that can really expand access to payments and financial services over time. It's important to remember that Libra will be governed both in terms of the currency, the reserve, but also the blockchain, not by Facebook, but by the Libra Association. So although the project was incubated in its original phases within Facebook, it's now being transitioned to the association, which will be the entity pushing it forward. What's important to keep in mind when thinking about Libra is that every decision in its original design was targeted at making it a useful medium of exchange, especially for transactions across borders, transactions that already involved currency conversions and that are currently fairly expensive. So if you look at, for example, some of the data from the World Bank, the average cost for sending a remittance today is about 7%. So these are markets where there's still substantial frictions and the cost borne often by relatively underbanked or unbanked segments of the population are still extremely high. So the goal is to create a cryptocurrency that can solve this vacuum and provide a unified payment solution that allows you to move value as efficiently as possible across the globe.
And so we have seen a number of different payment solutions come out over the years, from cryptos to M-Pesa, Alipay, WeChat. So all of these having varying success apart from crypto. Do you see where there might be a shortfall in the current monetary system that maybe Libra could solve?
Well, there are currently various solutions in place. When you look at the current system, then, like Christian indicated, especially across borders, the system is slow, it's expensive, and also for banks, it's cumbersome. You have to deal with different time zones, different opening hours across the globe. A lot of liquidity is tied up in the cross-border system. So it's certainly the case, I think, that the existing traditional cross-border financial plumbing could be improved upon. And in fact, there are a number of initiatives already underway there. And you have a number of fintechs that are, for example, specializing in remittances and other areas, but also banks are working on improving the existing system of correspondent banking. You mentioned cryptocurrency. Well, what we currently see, of course, is that the user base of cryptocurrency is still relatively limited, and that its exchange rate is volatile. And here, of course, Libra can make a difference, because Libra being tied to a basket of existing currency will be, from the outset, a much more stable currency. And its potential use base includes basically everybody with a Facebook account. So that's much larger. So that sets Libra very much apart from existing cryptocurrencies.
And Christian, do you agree with this? Do you think these issues can be overcome by Libra? How could it complement current systems and how it works now, the interoperability as well? Is that an issue?
So one of the unique features of the design of Libra, relative to, I think, a wealth of innovation that has been happening on other fronts in payment systems, is that the effort this time is to create something that can act as a globally accessible open standard for transactions. So you may ask, why did Facebook need to pass on this to the Libra Association? Well, the idea is to create a platform that is fully interoperable and that is fully open, so that different operators, different types of players and financial institutions can all use the same infrastructure and be compatible with each other. One of the shortcomings, not of the monetary system, but really of payment networks today, is that they're extremely fragmented. And for a while, there was a belief that cryptocurrencies could fill that vacuum. But as was mentioned before, one of the key challenges with many cryptocurrencies today is their extreme volatility. This makes them not great mediums of exchange, because, you know, if you're trying to just transfer value from A to B, and in that passage, or over the passage of a few weeks or even hours at times, the value reflected in that token can have wide swings in its price, then, you know, people become reluctant to use it actually as a payment vehicle. That's why, you know, early in the design of Libra, we decided that for Libra to be extremely useful and to actually serve as a medium of exchange, it needed to have backing. That's where kind of the reserve comes into play. That's where you see the use of currencies and kind of short-term debt by some of the world's most reputable and stable central banks. By bringing intrinsic value in the token from the beginning, and by making it not only preserve its value over time as much as possible, but also by making it extremely useful. The idea is really to enable a wealth of new applications and new innovations in payments and financial services over time. This goes back to some of the work I did at MIT on cryptocurrencies. When we could design the MIT digital currency experiment, I think part of the ambition was really to use cryptocurrencies to really expand access to these services, to allow sort of new innovations. And, you know, when you look back 6 years later, so we did that experiment in 2013, 2014, there's a number of promising technologies, but I think many of these have failed to gain sufficient momentum, at least in the use cases. So some people use some of these cryptocurrencies as a store of value. Libra is meant to be different. Libra is really meant to accelerate the work towards a low-cost, safe, and fully interoperable payments network.
You already mentioned the Libra reserve and, you know, bringing down the volatility by backing it with some intrinsic value. Maybe you can explain how the Libra reserve might work. What are the mechanisms and procedures for purchasing the underlying assets and issuing new Libra tokens?
So again, why is the Libra reserve there? The Libra reserve there is to achieve this goal of value preservation so that each coin essentially has intrinsic value from the moment the network launches. It's important to highlight that the design of the reserve is there to complement existing currencies. I know sometimes there's been some confusion around this topic, but Libra is not designed to replace any existing currency. It's really there to provide an additional layer, a payments network on top of it, to extend their functionality and enable all sort of new use cases. From a technical perspective, you know, what will go in the reserve? Well, it will be predominantly cash and very short-term debt from a limited set of central banks. It's important to highlight that these assets already exist today on the market. These are assets that are generated, controlled, and managed by central banks. And when you think about it from a macroeconomics perspective, Libra does not entail any new money creation. It's simply a claim backed by this already established and trustworthy asset. When we were early in the kind of the economic design of Libra, when we looked at, okay, what could really give stability, what could really give intrinsic value, it was clear that, you know, assets managed by central banks that have a long history of stability and low inflation were ideal for this part of the mission. Now, Libra, and this is kind of similar to the design of a currency board, does not have any discretion in monetary policy. And so this reserve will be operated under a very narrow, transparent, and clear mandate. We also expect there's been a number of interactions, of course, with central banks and other regulators, including, for example, the G7 Working Group on Stablecoins and FINMA. We expect all these regulators to help shape the final mandate and rules that the reserve will follow. And if you want to kind of visualize how this will work, something you can keep in mind is, like, you know, the currency board has operated, for example, by the Hong Kong Monetary Authority for decades. So from a practical standpoint, whenever demand for Libra increases, new coins will be minted in exchange for fiat, and that fiat will be placed in the reserve and used also to purchase, in part, very short-term government debt. These are highly liquid assets that, you know, in the case of a run or in case of a liquidation event, are easy to place on the market. On the opposite case, where demand contracts and people want fiat back for their coins, the coins are burnt or destroyed, and essentially fiat is returned to the market. So Libra really doesn't have any discretion in when to print money, when to print these coins, or when to destroy them. The market decides when more coins are needed, you know, for sending remittances, for sending cross-border payments.
I understand what Christian says, that Libra does not intend to have influence on monetary policy, if I summarize it in my own words. However, a question that I have there is that if Libra indeed grows big, becomes a success, and then it becomes a major buyer of safe assets over the globe, because for every Libra issued, a basket of safe assets or short-term government bonds or cash will be acquired. So that even by just being there, by being a successful coin, Libra will in fact influence existing financial markets and might also influence monetary policy, because it is a large buyer of safe assets. Or the other way around, if for some reason many people choose to sell their Libra, then the Libra Association will be a large seller of such safe assets. So I appreciate that you intend to be neutral towards monetary policy, but I think in practice, there will be influence on monetary policy and financial markets.
So I think first of all, and this maybe it's because, you know, when a tech company is involved, people tend to jump to very large scales and imagine worlds with no frictions. I think this time is different for a number of reasons. So first of all, for the reserve to grow, balances need to grow. And when you think about Libra is designed as a medium of exchange, and so the velocity of the coin is likely to be extremely high. So that's the first dimension that kind of slows down the growth of the reserve, because, you know, if I'm sending a remittance, the person on the other end will convert it into fiat and buy goods and services. That's kind of the most likely use cases for a very long time. Again, the velocity being high is not the only constraint on the size of the reserve. The other one being frictions in adoption. Take the wallet that Facebook would develop, Calibra. Every user that will onboard on Calibra will have to show a national document, go through a very rigorous KYC process that's there to ensure that the wallet, of course, complies with all financial regulations, AML, KYC, and everything else. This will be a big obstacle for converting users that maybe are on Facebook or are on WhatsApp or are on Messenger, but don't have a digital wallet. So the user base will also likely grow slowly. And so I think when people think about some of these systemic issues of the reserve, they tend to discount the fact that, first of all, the volume of transactions could be extremely high. You could have a lot of payments and cross-border transfer happening on Libra with a relatively small reserve, just because the velocity of the coin could be very high. And second, you'll take years, if not decades, for the reserve to grow to any meaningful size. And that size is still likely to be very small relative to many of these markets. When you think about short-term debt, there's extreme liquidity in those markets, and Libra is likely to be a tiny, tiny player for a very long time. So I think it's always important to remember that the scale is not going to be the one that some people seem to project, mostly because there's lots of friction, there's last mile issues. And that's why, you know, a lot of these payment solutions, especially in developing countries, take mobile money, extremely successful in some regions, not so much in others. And that really relates to the fact that the last mile between the offline interaction and the online digital payment is one that is very costly to overcome and takes a lot of effort and time.
So Christian, what would happen if suddenly this basket becomes zero negative yielding in that case? Is there a chance to maybe see some instability in the token's value?
It's important to think about the different parts of the basket. So if you look, for example, at the FINMA guidelines that have come out, one of the things that was really clear from FINMA is that one of the necessary conditions for Libra being granted kind of a payment system license, which is the one that the association is pursuing at this point, is that the returns and risk associated with the management of the reserve would have to be borne by Libra, not by the holder of the coin. And so when you think about this, the returns on the reserve or their absence are really relevant for the entities investing in the network, not for the users. You think about zero yields, you know, they would just delay the return. And here again, we're assuming an extreme scenario where the average yield of the entire basket is zero or negative. That's something that the investors would have to worry about. And over the next few months, as the reserve management policy becomes more clear, also based on the feedback from regulators, including, of course, central banks, that management policy will list, you know, what are the conditions and what are the responses in cases like this. More generally, I think you could imagine over time, this is more of an issue as the reserve grows in size. There may be new solutions for the association to custody cash. There's been mentioned, for example, by some of the central banks of opening the overnight window to some of the tech companies. If that became a possibility, that would also change the conditions under which the reserve could operate in a negative yield environment. I think more generally, this is something that the association is working to define more clearly and to get clarity on. But from a user perspective, it won't matter because, again, the FINMA guidelines state really clearly that both returns and risk will be borne by the investors and the association, not the users.
Given that the target audience for Libra come from countries with mainly volatile currencies, so emerging market countries, there's more risk of value changes from cross-border flows. So do you see any problems which may happen in the initial buying stage from emerging market countries? So people holding non-Libra reserve currencies finding it increasingly more expensive to buy Libra as their domestic currencies continually depreciate against it. Jonas, do you see any risk here?
There could be, although at the same time, when you look from an emerging market perspective, for their foreign currency relations, they are mostly dominated by the dollar currently. So from the perspective of emerging markets, it's indeed the question, do we exchange a dollar dominated foreign currency exchange market for maybe, for some transactions, a Libra-dominated market. And both the dollar and the Libra are, from an emerging market perspective, probably strong currencies. Maybe Libra even a bit less strong, depending on what currencies will participate in its basket. So, yeah, for me, it's an open question whether this is a big problem for emerging market users, at least when you compare it to the current situation, where they have to also deal with hard currencies for their international transactions.
Christian, do you see an issue? So a lot of these people pay, save, and invest in the domestic currencies now, having to buy into Libra, which becomes more and more expensive for them if their currencies continually depreciate. Do you see any problems there?
I think it's important to remember, again, what is Libra designed for? What is Libra optimized and what is it not? So if you're sending a cross-border transaction, if you're receiving a remittance, or for example, if you're a tourist traveling in a foreign country, in all these cases, Libra may be a more compelling solution. And so we expect all sort of extensive margin and new applications to emerge that take advantage of these lower frictions, lower costs, lower time of settlement for this type of payments. Now, in a domestic market, I think the use case is way less compelling because as a domestic user, now you're kind of exposed to the fluctuations of what you can consider just another foreign currency. Now, going back to the setting of developing countries, first of all, as was already hinted at, you know, the dollar or the euro, these currencies are already present in many of these markets. They're way more liquid. They also have a physical presence in those regions. And Libra is unlikely, I think, to displace any of these use cases. And to the specific example of the currency depreciating against Libra, if you had a balance in Libra, well, now that's kind of good news for you because that balance is kind of worth more in your local currency. But of course, fluctuations can go either direction. More broadly, if you're using Libra to receive a remittance and then you use it to buy goods and services in these regions, that exposure will be minimal. And so I think that kind of problem is much less pronounced than in the case where you were using it as a store of value. I think more broadly, it's important to remember that when people will adopt in developing economies, it will be probably mostly be driven by the medium of exchange use case. That's kind of what Libra is useful for. And so the exposure to FX may be fairly limited for these users, especially because, you know, the more underbanked or unbanked they are, the more they really need that value to be spent in good services, tuition for their kids or immediate needs.
So we mentioned that there has been some pushback from global regulators already. Some view the project as a significant challenge to sovereignty. How have those conversations progressed so far, Christian? And Jonas, what issues do you think regulators are most concerned with about the whole project?
Part of the goal of announcing the project with a launching, and so giving us plenty of time, was to really gather feedback from all sort of regulators, different types of institutions, from central banks, institutions like the SEC, about the proposed economic design, the proposed rules for regulatory frameworks like AML and KYC. So I would say the process has been very constructive. We received a lot of thoughtful feedback. And, you know, we're incorporating that now. And the association is kind of leading changes to the different parts of the design to really accommodate what we're seeing from global regulators. So I think this is part of the process that we really triggered with the announcement. And the idea was to ensure that we get the design right. So this is something that really requires collaboration and feedback from all sort of different stakeholders. It's not just a project that you could just launch in some shape or form and then change after. So I think we recognize that this part is extremely important for refining the design of Libra.
Yeah, I think regulators are a bit caught by surprise by the announcement of a global currency. I think indeed that regulators and central banks in particular are thinking beyond Libra as just a remittance currency. They're thinking about, okay, what happens if such a currency is used for more than just remittances, if it's also being used for domestic transactions, if people choose to hold a significant amount of their savings, for example, in Libra. And for central banks in particular, at that point, they start to worry about their sovereignty, about their monetary sovereignty. Because currently central banks, they set interest rates, they control the money supply, albeit indirectly, but still they control the money supply in their country. In some countries in the world, cross-border capital flows are tightly managed. And when you have a global currency, then, and especially if such a global currency is adopted by many people, then central banks obviously lose influence. They lose their monetary influence. Well, basically, such influence transfers to a sort of a global central bank. The Libra Association would then become sort of a global central bank. And as we discussed earlier, of course, Libra is indeed not in the business of setting monetary policy, but from the perspective of a small domestic economy or a small central bank, having its domestic economy basically mostly liberalized, so maybe not dollarized, but liberalized, means that in effect they have to cede monetary sovereignty. And I think this is a major concern for central banks. And also, interestingly here, probably responses vary much between different countries. You could imagine, for example, like the United States or the Eurozone, very much attached to their current currencies, while emerging markets may be more inclined to think, well, okay, currently I'm facing a dollarized economy, or I'm forced to do my international transactions mostly in dollars, and my corporations are already borrowing in dollars. So, well, if I exchange this dollar dominance for a Libra dominance, well, they may care less about that than the United States, which potentially stands to lose its the dollar as a reserve world currency, or the Eurozone with the Euro as a dominant currency, let alone China, which also has its own policy agenda in this respect.
I would like to reiterate that, you know, Libra is not designed to replace the US dollar or any other currency. And if you go back to fundamentals, the fact that it is optimized as a medium of exchange and really enable cheap and fast payments, that's very different than a currency role, and especially than fiat. It is a payment network, and it's meant to enable payment services. Now, even in a scenario where Libra is widely adopted, and again, as I mentioned before, there's friction for wide adoption that I think the problem will encounter in many of these markets, central banks will retain their ability to set nominal interest rates, or, you know, exchange rates, whatever they're focused on. And these are key levers of modern monetary policy. So Libra will not take away any of those levers. One of the changes from a macro perspective that you may see in a scenario of wide adoption of Libra would be an increase in the velocity of money, because these Libra coin being digital could change hands more rapidly. And that's a change that central banks already know how to accommodate because of decades of improvements in payment technology. So it's nothing new. It's something that is well understood. And again, doesn't have a direct impact on the money supply. Now, the issue about developing countries, I think there's kind of two sets. First of all, as was already mentioned, many of these economies are already relying in some shape or form on the dollar, or maybe the euro partially. And those currencies have way more liquidity, way more established markets than Libra will have. But if those countries don't have capital controls, it's important to remember that all the assets that will be in the basket of Libra are already freely accessible today in those countries. So in that sense, Libra is nothing new. It may expand access to those assets potentially to some of the segments of the population that are currently excluded. And often, again, those segments unfortunately tend to be less wealthy and have much less assets available. Where capital controls are in place instead, so imagine a country that does not want capital outflows or doesn't want, you know, the use of the dollar already locally, governments typically have restrictions on the flows that can take place. And since the wallets operating on the Libra network will be regulated in those local jurisdictions, they will apply the same rules that a traditional financial players would be. And so the way Libra will be used or not used will be really under the control of these local governments. That said, of course, you know, we understand that a new asset, a new innovation introduces new questions. And so part of the process with regulators and engaging with policymakers is really to ensure that in different regions where there's different needs, where from a macro perspective, of course, there's different types of questions, Libra is designed in a way to smoothly integrate with the local environment and not to cause any issues. But again, at the high level, I think it's important always to remember that it's optimized for cross-border medium of exchange use cases, and the wallets will have to operate under the local jurisdictions. And so, you know, when people imagine sudden large flight to Libra, that wouldn't be possible if there's restrictions on capital controls already in those regions.
So this also relates to something Mark Carney mentioned in Jackson Hole. Do you think a sovereign issued digital reserve currency could work just as well for cross-border payments, something like an ESDR, Jonas?
It all depends indeed on the infrastructure, right? Because it's less about, I think, who exactly issues this currency, whether it's indeed a global consortium of central banks or the Libra Association, but it's more about indeed the infrastructure, the smoothness of the infrastructure, the accessibility of the infrastructure, that matters. And I think indeed at the global level, there is a need to improve the payment infrastructure, because like we discussed at the beginning, the current system of correspondent banking is running into its limits. So yes, there's room for improvement, but for me, the main question mark remains, yes, there is room for technical improvement and for infrastructure improvements, but do you actually need a single currency also to have these improvements? I think you can also have these improvements by using technology innovations like blockchain-based platforms with tokens, but well, using multiple currencies on those infrastructures.
So maybe does a central bank digital currency work in that case? If you better the current payment systems now in each domestic jurisdiction, could you have a centrally bank issued digital currency? Would that work, Jonas?
Of course, indeed, this is something that many central banks debate. And I think that many central banks are still agnostic as to the question, should central banks issue digital currencies? Should the private sector do it? I think in the end, it's really about what are you trying to achieve and what problem are you trying to solve? And in many cases, this will be an improvement of the infrastructure, improvement of accessibility of payment systems. And well, we know from the existing systems that it's more or less a public-private partnership. In most countries, the payment system is built and executed by mostly the private sector, but it's overseen, supervised, and regulated by the public sector, by the central banks. And in the end, also the central banks provide the backbone of the infrastructure. And so there's really a symbiotic relationship between the private and the public sector in the payment systems. And I expect basically future innovations, including digital currencies, to also go down this path. So a role for both the public and the private sector, and the private sector for its expertise, and the public sector, because in the end, money is a public good, the public sector has to be involved one way or another.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, building on that, I think this symbiotic relationship between private and public sector is exactly in the design of Libra. So if you imagine a future where central bank digital currencies are available, they could be integrated tightly in the operations of the reserve. And in fact, it would simplify the operations of the reserve because the two blockchains could potentially talk to each other. But I think what's interesting here is really to think about in terms of comparative advantage. I think as was said, of course, the money, value preservation, stability, all those elements are public good. And so, you know, Libra is designed to recognize that and to build on that. On top of that, you can build an open payment and financial network, and that can be a broader effort with both public organizations, so but also nonprofits. So, for example, the Libra Association will have NGOs and other social impact partners that will ensure that the network can also be used for all sort of goals around financial inclusion. And so if you think about these two layers, the public layer and then the applications on top of it, Libra is really meant to extend the functionality at the top layer and to enable cheaper, faster settlement and new types of applications through, for example, the smart programming language, but it's not meant to replace the bottom part. And that's why, for example, the reserve is built exactly on what is available today from the public sector. But I'm sure that any development on the public side will be welcomed, and it would be actually a great addition for Libra, because now you, of course, could have all sort of more efficient on and off ramps in regions that do have a central bank digital currency.
And just to bring the conversation back to regulation, Christian, how are you doing with regard to identity-less accounts? Is it important to have well-defined AML and KYC regulation and consumer data protection for a payment system?
Of course. You know, I think fighting financial crime and ensuring that bad activities like money laundering or terrorism financing cannot take advantage of any new network is extremely important. And so the Libra Association, as part of its different work stream, is developing a comprehensive framework to readdress this concern and really port some of those rules and protocols on a blockchain-like system. From Facebook's perspective, so the wallet Calibra, of course, will incorporate, you know your customer and anti-money laundering methodologies, which will rely, of course, on ID and also information that's needed to really do risk-based customer due diligence. I think more generally, I think what's interesting is that there's a lot of innovation in this space, new techniques from machine learning to different types of monitoring. And so I think there's a chance here more broadly to improve on the efficacy of this instrument by really enabling a new type of network that both serves this mission of an efficient payment and medium of exchange, but not at the cost, of course, of more financial crime. So some of these regulations and implementations have been in place for many years, and I think there's a chance here to use technology to improve on them and make the network safe and secure.
So is there a challenge maybe if there is no verifiable national identity in certain countries, you could potentially have financial exclusion in that case? Is that something that you've considered as well in the design?
Yes, and that's why, of course, the role of some of the NGOs that are participating, even as founding members, and the new ones that I guess will be added as the founding set expands, will play a key role. Again, going back to public-private partnerships, you could imagine efforts for some of the global NGOs in some of these regions to establish new types of identity systems. I think there's been experiments in some of these regions, in some of these contexts, in ensuring that some of these people that are, of course, unbanked or don't have access to any sort of financial service can access these new networks. I think it will be work in progress. And again, those last mile frictions, of which identity is, of course, a piece, will require a lot of work, not just by the Libra Association, by all of its founding members and some of the public institutions to ensure that, you know, the broader goal of financial inclusion can be really delivered on.
On that final point, that concludes this week's podcast. Join us again next week where we continue the conversation on Facebook's Libra, focusing on the Libra blockchain, the technology practicalities, and the process of running a permission system, which aims to become less permissioned over time.